Chapter 13. The Form World of Economic Life. A. Money. 1. The standpoint from which to comprehend the economic history of great cultures is not to be looked for on economic ground. Economic thought and action are a side of life that acquires a false appearance when regarded as a self-contained kind of life. Least of all is the secure standpoint to be had on the basis of the present-day world economics, which for the last 150 years has been mounting fantastically, perilously, and in the end almost desperately, an economics, moreover, that is exclusively Western dynamic, anything but common human. That which we call national economy today is built up on premises that are openly and specifically English. The industry of machines, which is unknown to all other cultures, stands in the centre as though it were a matter of course and, without men being conscious of the fact, completely dominates the formulation of ideas and the deduction of so-called laws. Credit money, in the special form imparted to it by the relations of world trade and export industry, in a peasantless England, serves as the foundation whereupon to define words like capital, value, price, property. And the definitions are then transferred without more ado to other culture stages and life cycles. The insular position of England has determined a conception of politics and of its relation to economics that rules in all economic theories. The creators of this economic picture were David Hume and Adam Smith, the authors respectively of Political Discourses, 1752, and the celebrated Wealth of Nations, 1776. Everything that has since been written about them or against them always presupposes the critical structure and methods of their systems. This is true of Carey and Liszt, as it is of Fourier and LaSalle. As for Smith's greatest adversary, Marx, it matters little how loudly one protests against English capitalism when one is thoroughly imbued with its images. The protest is itself a recognition, and its only aim is, through a new kind of accounting, to confer upon objects the advantage of being subjects. From Adam Smith to Marx, it is nothing but self-analysis of the economic thinking of a single culture on a particular development level. Rationalistic through and through, it starts from material and its conditions, needs and motives, instead of from the soul of generations, estates and peoples, and its creative power. It looks upon men as constituent parts of situations and knows nothing of the big personality and history-shaping will of individuals or of groups, the will that sees in the facts of economics not ends, but means. It takes economic life to be something that can be accounted for without remainder by visible causes and effects, something of which the structure is quite mechanical and completely self-contained, and even, finally, something that stands in some sort of causal relation to religion and politics. These again being considered as individual self-contained domains. As this outlook is the systematic and not the historical, the timeless and universal validity of its concepts and rules is an article of faith, and its ambition is to establish the one and only correct method of applying the science of management. And accordingly, wherever its truths have come into contact with the facts, it has experienced a complete fiasco, as was the case with the prophecies of bourgeois theorists concerning the World War. It was the opinion of the expert almost everywhere that the economic consequences of general mobilization would compel the breaking up of hostilities within a few weeks, and with those of proletarian theorists on the induction of the Soviet economy. Up to now, therefore, there has been no national economy, in the sense of a morphology of the economic side of life, and more particularly of that side in the life of the high cultures, with their formations, concordant as to stage, tempo and duration of economic styles. Economics has no system, but a physiognomy. To fathom the secret of its inner form, its soul, demands the physiognomic flair. To succeed in it, it is necessary to be a judge of it, as one is a judge of men or of horses, and requires even less knowledge than that which a horseman needs to have of zoology. But this faculty of judgment can be awakened, and the way to awaken it is through the sympathetic outlook on history, which gives a shrewd idea of the race instincts, which are at work in the economic as in other constituents of active existence, symbolically shaping the external position, the economic stuff, the need, in harmony with their own inner character. All economic life is the expression of a soul life. This is a new, a German outlook upon economics, an outlook from beyond all capitalism and socialism, both of which were products of the jejune rationality of the 18th century and aimed at nothing but a material analysis and subsequent synthesis of the economic surface. All that has been taught hitherto is no more than preparatory. Economic thought, like legal, stands now on the verge of its true and proper development, which, for us, as for the Hellenistic Roman age, sets in only where art and philosophy have irrevocably passed away. The attempt which follows is meant only as a flying survey of the possibilities here available. Economics and politics are sides of the one livingly flowing current of being, and not of the waking consciousness, the intellect. In each of them is manifested the pulse of the cosmic flowings that are occluded in the sequent generations of individual existences. They may be said not to have history, but to be history. Irreversible time, the when, rules in them. They belong, both of them, to race and not, as religion and science belong, to language with its spatial causal tensions. They regard facts, not truths. There are economic destinies as there are political, whereas in scientific doctrines, as in religious, there is timeless connection of cause and effect. Life, therefore, has a political and an economic kind of condition of fitness for history. They overlie, they support, they oppose each other. But the political is unconditionally the first. Life's will is to preserve itself and to prevail, or rather to make itself stronger in order that it may prevail. But in the economic state of fitness, the being streams are fit as self-regarding, whereas in a political, they are fit as other-regarding. And this holds good all along the series, from the simplest unicellular plant to swarms and to peoples of the highest free mobility in space. Nourishment and winning through, the difference of dignity between the two sides of life, is recognizable in their relation to death. There is no contrast so profound as that between hunger death and hero death. Economically, life is in the widest sense threatened, dishonored, and debased by hunger, with which is to be included stunting of possibilities, straitened circumstances, darkness, and pressure not less than starvation in the literal sense. Whole peoples have lost the tense force of their race through the gnawing wretchedness of their living. Here men die of something, and not for something. Politics sacrifices men for an idea. They fall for an idea. But economy merely wastes them away. War is the creator, hunger the destroyer of all great things. In war, life is elevated by death, often to that point of irresistible force whose mere existence guarantees victory. But in the economic life, hunger awakens the ugly, vulgar, and wholly unmetaphysical sort of fearfulness for one's life, under which the higher form world of a culture miserably collapses, and the naked struggle for existence of the human beasts begins. The double sense of all history that is manifested in man and woman has been discussed in an earlier chapter. There is a private history which represents life in space as a procreation series of the generations, and a public history that defends and secures it as a political informness, the spindle side and the sword side of being. They find expression in the ideas of family and of state, but also in the primary forms of the house, wherein the good spirits of the marriage bed, the genius and the Juno of every old Roman dwelling, were protected by that of the door, the Janus. To this private history of the family, the economic now attached itself. The duration of a flourishing life is inseparable from its strength. Its secret of begetting and conceiving is seen at its purest in the being of breed-strong peasant stock that is rooted, healthy and fruitful in its soil. And as, in the form of the body, the organ of sex is bound up with that of the circulation, so the middle of the house, in another sense, is formed by the sacred hearths, the Vesta. For this very reason, the significance of economic history is something quite different from that of political. In the latter, the foreground is taken up by the great individual destinies, which fulfil themselves indeed in the binding forms of their epoch, but are nevertheless, each in itself, strictly personal. The concern of the former, and of family history, is the course of development of the form language. Everything once occurring and personal is an unimportant private destiny, and only the basic form common to the million cases matters. But even so, economics is only a foundation for being that is in any way meaningful. What really signifies is not that an individual or a people is in condition, well-nourished and fruitful, but for what he or it is so. And the higher man climbs historically, the more conspicuously his political and religious will to inward symbolism and force of expression towers above everything in the way of form and depth that the economic life as such possesses. It is only with the coming of the civilization, when the whole form world begins to ebb, that mere life-preserving begins to outline itself, nakedly and insistently. This is the time when the banal assertion that hunger and love are the driving forces of life ceases to be ashamed of itself. When life comes to mean not a waxing in strength for the task, but a matter of happiness of the greatest number, of comfort and ease, of panem et circenses, and when in the place of grand politics we have economic politics as an end in itself. Since economics belongs to the race side of life, it possesses, like politics, a customary ethic and not a moral. Yet again the distinction of nobility and priesthood, facts and truths. A vocation class, like an estate, possesses a matter-of-course feeling for not good and evil, but good and bad. Not to have this feeling is to be void of honour, law. For those engaged in the economic life, too, honour stands as central criterion, with its tact and fine flair for what is the right thing. Something quite separate from the sin idea underlying the religious contemplation of the world. There exists not only a very definite vocational honour amongst merchants, craftsmen and peasants, but equally definite gradations downward for the shopkeeper, the exporter, the banker, the contractor, and even, as we all know, for thieves and beggars, insofar as two or three of them feel themselves as fellow practitioners. No one has stated or written out these customary ethics, but they exist, and like class ethics everywhere and always, they are binding only within the circle of membership. Along with the noble virtues of loyalty and courage, chivalry and comradeship, which are found in every vocational society, there appear clean-cut notions of the ethical value of industry, of success, of work, and an astonishing sense of distinction and apartness. This sort of thing a man has, and without knowing much about it, for custom is evidence to consciousness only when it is infringed, while, on the contrary, the prohibitions of religion, which are timeless, universally valid, but never realizable ideals, must be learnt before a man can know or attempt to follow them. Religious ascetic fundamentals, such as selfless, sinless, are without meaning in the economic life. For the true saint, economics in itself is sinful, and not merely taking of interest, or pleasure in riches, or the envy of the poor. Footnote. Negotium, by which is meant every form of gainful activity, negat otium neque quaerit veram quietem quae est Deus, are the words of the Decretum Gratiani. End of footnote. The saying concerning the lilies of the field is for deeply religious and philosophical natures unreservedly true. The whole weight of their being lies outside economics and politics and all other facts of this world. We see it in Jesus's times and St. Bernard's and in the Russian soul of today. We see it too in the way of life of a Diogenes and a Kant. For its sake men choose voluntary poverty and itinerancy and hide themselves in cells and studies. Economic activity is never found in a religion or a philosophy, always only in the political organism of a church or the social organism of a theorizing fellowship. It is ever a compromise with this world and an index of the presence of a will to power. Extended footnote. Pilate's question settles also the relation of economy to science. The religious man will always try in vain, catechism in hand, to improve the instincts of his political environment. But it goes on its way undisturbed and leaves him to his thoughts. The saint can only choose between adapting himself to this environment, and then he becomes a church politician and conscienceless, and fleeing from it into a hermitage, or even into the beyond. But the same happens also, and here not without a comic side to it, in the intellectualism of the city. The philosopher who has built up an ethical social system that is replete with virtue, and of course the only true one, may enlighten the economic life as to how it should behave and at what it should aim. It is even the same spectacle whether labelled liberal, anarchistic or socialistic, or derived from Plato, Proudhon or Marx. Here too, economy carries on undisturbed and leaves the thinker to choose between withdrawing, to pour out on paper his lamentations of this world, and entering it as an economic politician, in which case he either makes himself ridiculous, or else promptly throws his theory to the devil and starts to win himself a leading place. End of extended footnote. 2. That which may be called the economic life of the plant is accomplished on and in it without its being itself anything but the theatre and will-less object of a natural process. This element underlies the economy of the human body also, still unalterably vegetal and dreamy, pursuing its will-less, in this respect almost alien, existence in the shape of the circulatory organs. But when we come to the animal body freely mobile in space, being is not alone. It is accompanied by waking being, the comprehending apprehension, and therefore the compulsion to provide by independent thought for the preservation of life. Here begins life anxiety, leading to touch and scent, sight and hearing with ever sharper senses, and presently to movements in space for the purpose of searching, gathering, pursuing, tricking, stealing, which develop in many species of animals, such as beavers, ants, bees, numerous birds and beasts of prey, into a rudimentary economy technique, which presupposes a process of reflection and, therefore, a certain emancipation of understanding from sensation. Man is genuinely man, inasmuch as his understanding has freed itself from sensation and, as thought, intervened creatively in the relations between microcosm and macrocosm. Quite animal still is the trickery of woman towards man, and equally so the peasant's shrewdness in obtaining small advantages, both differing in no wise from the slyness of the fox, both consisting in the ability to see into the secret of the victim at one glance. But on top of this, there supervenes now the economic thought that sows a field, tames animals, changes and appreciates and exchanges things, and finds a thousand ways and means of better preserving life and transforming a dependence upon the environment into a mastery over it. That is the underlayer of all cultures. Race makes use of an economic thought that can become so powerful as to detach itself from given purposes, build up castles of abstraction, and finally lose itself in utopian expanses. All higher economic life develops itself on and over a peasantry. Peasantry per se does not presuppose any basis but itself. Footnote. Exactly the same is true of wandering bands of hunters and pastorals. But the economic foundation of the great culture is always a mankind that adheres fast to the soil and nourishes and supports the higher economic forms. End of footnote. It is, so to say, race in itself, plant-like and historyless, producing and using wholly for itself, with an outlook on the world that sweepingly regards every other economic existence as incidental and contemptible. To this producing kind of economy, there is presently opposed an acquisitive kind, which makes use of the former as an object, as a source of nourishment, tribute, or plunder. Politics and trade are in their beginnings quite inseparable, both being masterful, personal, warlike, both with a hunger for power and booty that produces quite another outlook upon the world. An outlook not from an angle into it, but from above, down on its tempting disorder. An outlook which is pretty candidly expressed in the choice of the lion and the bear, the hawk and the falcon, as armorial badges. Primitive war is always also booty war, and primitive trade intimately related to plunder and piracy. The Icelandic sagas narrate how, often, the Vikings would agree with the town population for a market piece of a fortnight, after which weapons were drawn and booty-making started. Politics and trade, in developed form, the art of achieving material successes over an opponent by means of intellectual superiority, are both a replacement of war by other means. Every kind of diplomacy is of a business nature, every business of a diplomatic, and both are based upon penetrative judgment of men and physiognomic tact. The adventure spirit in great seafarers like the Phoenicians, Etruscans, Normans, Venetians, Hanseatics, the spirit of shrewd banking lords like the Fugger and the Medici, and of mighty financiers like Crassus, and the mining and trust magnates of our own day, must possess the strategic talent of the general if its operations are to succeed. Pride in the clan house, the paternal heritage, the family tradition, develops and counts in the economic sphere as in the political. The great fortunes are like the kingdoms and have their history, and Polycrates and Solon, Lorenzo de Medici and Jürgen Wullenweber are far from being the only examples of political ambitions developing out of commercial. Undershaft in Shaw's Major Barbara is a true ruler figure of this realm. But the genuine prince and statesman wants to rule, and the genuine merchant only wants to be wealthy. And here the acquisitive economy divides to pursue aim and means separately. Footnote. As a means for governments, it is called finance economy, financial policy. Here the whole nation is the object of a levy of tribute in the forms of taxes and customs, of which the purpose is not to make, so to say, the upkeep of its life more comfortable, but to secure its historical position and to enhance its power. End of footnote. One may aim at booty for the sake of power, or at power for the sake of booty. The great ruler too, the Huang Ti, the Tiberius, the Frederick II, has the will to wealth, the will to be rich in land and subjects, but it is with and under a sense of high responsibilities. A man may lay hands on the treasures of the whole world with a good conscience, not to say as a matter of course. He may lead a life of radiant splendour, or even dissipation, if only he feels himself, Napoleon, Cecil Rhodes, the Roman Senate of the 3rd century, to be the engine of a mission. When he feels so, the idea of private property can scarcely be said to exist so far as he is concerned. He who is out for purely economic advantages, as the Carthaginians were in Roman times, and, in a far greater degree still, the Americans in ours, is correspondingly incapable of purely political thinking. In the decisions of high politics, he is ever deceived and made a tool of, as the case of Wilson shows, especially when the absence of statesmanlike instinct leaves a chair vacant for moral sentiments. This is why the great economic groupings of the present day, for example, employers and employees' unions, pile one political failure on another, unless, indeed, they find a real political politician as leader, and he makes use of them. Economic and political thinking, in spite of a high degree of consonance of form, are in direction, and therefore in all tactical details, basically different. Great business successes, using the phrase widely as including, for instance, the rise of workmen, journalists, and men of learning to positions of leadership, awaken an unbridled sense of public power. In the very word capital, one catches an unmistakable undertone of this. But it is only in a few individuals that the colour and direction of their willing and their criteria of situations of things undergo change. Only when a man has really ceased to feel his enterprise as his own business and its aim as the simple amassing of property does it become possible for the captain of industry to become the statesman, the Cecil Rhodes. But conversely, the men of the political world are exposed to the danger of their will and thought for historical tasks degenerating into mere provision for their private life upkeep. Then a nobility can become a robber order, and we see emerging the familiar types of princes and ministers, demagogues and revolution heroes, whose zeal exhausts itself in lazy comfortableness and the piling up of immense riches. There is little to choose in this respect between Versailles and the Jacobin Club, business bosses and trade union leaders, Russian governors and Bolshevists. And in the maturity of democracy, the politics of those who have got there, not merely with business, but with speculative business of the dirtiest great city sort. All this, however, is the very manifestation of the hidden course of a high culture. In the beginning appear the primary orders, nobility and priesthood, with their symbolism of time and space. The political life, like the religious experience, has its fixed place, its ordained adepts, and its allotted aims for facts and truths alike in a well-ordered society. And down below, the economic life moves unconscious along a sure path. Then the stream of being becomes entangled in the stone structures of the town, and intellect and money thenceforward take over its historical guidance. The heroic and the saintly, with their youthful symbolic force, become rarer and withdraw into narrower and narrower circles. Cool bourgeois clarity takes their place. At bottom, the concluding of a system and the concluding of a deal call for one and the same kind of professional intelligence. Scarcely differentiated now by any measure of symbolic force, political and economic life, religious and scientific experience make each other's acquaintance, jostle one another, commingle. In the frictions of the city, the stream of being loses its strict, rich form. Elementary economic factors come to the surface and interplay with the remains of form-imbued politics, just as sovereign science at the same time adds religion to its stock of objects. Over a life of economics, political self-satisfaction spreads a critical, edifying world sentiment. But out of it all emerge, in place of the decayed estates, the individual life courses, big with true political or religious force, that are to become destiny for the whole. And thus we begin to discern the morphology of economic history. First, there is a primitive economy of man, which, like that of plants and animals, follows a biological timescale in the development of its forms. It completely dominates the primitive age, and it continues to move on, infinitely slowly and confusedly, underneath and between the high cultures. Animals and plants are brought into it and transformed by taming and breeding, selection and sowing. Fire and metals are exploited, and the properties of inorganic nature made, by technical processes, serviceable for the conduct of life. All this is perfused with political, religious ethic and meaning, without its being possible distinctly to separate totem and taboo, hunger, soul fear, sex love, art, war, sacrificial rites, belief and experience. Wholly different from this, both in idea and in evolution, and sharply marked off in tempo and duration, are the economic histories of the high cultures, each of which has its own economic style. To feudalism belongs the economy of the townless countryside. With the state ruled radially from cities appears the urban economy of money, and this rises, with the oncoming of the civilization, into the dictature of money, simultaneously with the victory of world city democracy. Every culture has its own independently developed form world. Bodily money of the Apollinean style, that is, the stamped coin, is as antithetical to relational money of the Faustian dynamic style, that is, the booking of credit units, as the polis is to the state of Charles V. But the economic life, just like the social, forms itself pyramidally. In the rustic underground, a thoroughly primitive condition maintains itself almost unaffected by the culture. The late urban economy, which is already the activity of a resolute minority, looks down with steady contempt upon the pristine land economy that continues all around it, while the latter, in turn, glares sulkily at the intellectualized style that prevails within the walls. Finally, the cosmopolis brings in a civilized world economy, which radiates from very small nuclei within a few centers and subjects the rest to itself as a provincial economy, while in the remoter landscapes thoroughly primitive patriarchal custom often prevails still. With the growth of the cities, the way of life becomes ever more artificial, subtle and complex. The great city worker of Caesar's Rome, of Harun al-Rashid's Baghdad, and of the present-day Berlin feels, as self-evidently necessary, much that the richest yeoman deep in the country regards as silly luxury. But this self-evident standard is hard to reach and hard to maintain. In every culture, the quantum of work grows bigger and bigger, till at the beginning of every civilization, we find an intensity of economic life, of which the tensions are even excessive and dangerous, and which it is impossible to maintain for a long period. In the end, a rigid, permanent set condition is reached, a strange hodgepodge of refined intellectual and crude primitive factors, such as the Greeks found in Egypt and we have found in modern India and China, unless, of course, the crust is being disintegrated from below by the pressure of a young culture, like the classical in Diocletian's time. Relatively to this economic movement, men are economically in form as an economic class, just as they are in form for world history as a political estate. Each individual has an economic position within the economic order, just as he has a grade of some sort in the society. Now, both these kinds of allegiances make claims upon the feelings, thoughts, and relations all at once. A life insists on being, and on meaning something as well. And the confusion of our ideas is made worse, confounded by the fact that today, as in Hellenistic times, political parties, in their desire to ameliorate the upkeep standards of certain economic groups, have elevated these groups to the dignity of a political estate, as Marx, for instance, elevated the class of factory workers. Confusion, for the first and genuine estate is nobility. From it, the officer and the judge, and all concerned in the highest duties of government and administration, are direct derivatives. They are estate-like formations that mean something. So too the body of scholars and scientists belongs to the priesthood and has a very sharply definite kind of class exclusiveness. Footnote. Including the medical profession, which indeed is indistinguishable in primitive times from the priests and magicians. End of footnote. But the grand symbolism of the estates goes out with castle and cathedral. The tiers already is the non-estate, the remainder, a miscellaneous and manifold congerie, which means very little as such, save in the moments of political protest, so that the importance it creates for itself is a party importance. The individual is conscious of himself not as a bourgeois, but because he is a liberal, and thus part and parcel of a great thing, not indeed as representing it in his person, but as adhering to it from conviction. In consequence of this weakness of its social form, the economic form of the bourgeoisie becomes all the more relatively conspicuous in its callings, guilds, and unions. In the cities, at any rate, a man is primarily designated according to the way in which he makes his living. Economically, the first, and anciently almost the only, mode of life is that of the peasant, which is pure production, and therefore the precondition of every other mode. Footnote. Herdsmen, fishermen, and hunters included. There is, moreover, a strange and very profound relation between peasant and miner, evidenced in ancient sagas and rites. The metals are coaxed out of the shaft, as the corn out of the earth, and the game out of the thicket. And for the real miner, even metal is something that lives and grows. End of footnote. Even the primary estates, too, in early times, based their way of life entirely upon hunting, stock-keeping, and agricultural landowning. And even in late periods, land is regarded by nobles and priests as the only truly honourable kind of property. In opposition to it stands trade, the mode of the acquisitive middleman or intervener, powerful out of all proportion to its numbers, already indispensable even in quite early conditions, a refined parasitism, completely unproductive, and therefore land alien and far-ranging, free and unhampered spiritually too by the ethic and the practice of the countryside, a life sustaining itself on another life. Footnote. This is true from the earliest sea voyaging to the bourse of the world city, and all traffic, whether by river, road, or rail, belongs with it. End of footnote. Between the two, now, a third kind of economy, the preparatory economy of technics, grows up in numberless crafts, industries, and callings, which creatively apply reflections upon nature, and whose honour and conscience are bound up in achievement. Footnote. With this belong the machine industry, with its purely Western type of the inventor and engineer, and practically also a great part of the modern agronomy, as for instance in America. End of footnote. Its oldest guild, which reaches back into the sheer primitive and fills the picture of this primitive with its dark sagas and rites and notions, is the Guild of the Smiths, who, as the result of their proud aloofness from the peasantry and the fear that hangs about them and leads to their being venerated and banned by turns, have often become true tribes with a race of their own, as in the case of the Abyssinian Falasha, or Black Jews. Footnote. Even today, the mining and metal industries are felt to be somehow nobler than, for example, the chemical and electrical. They possess the most ancient patent of nobility in the technical world, and a relic of cult mystery lies over them. End of footnote. In these three economics of production, preparation, and distribution, as in everything else belonging to politics and life at large, there are the subjects and objects of leading. In this case, whole groups that dispose, decide, organize, discover, and other whole groups whose function is simply to execute. The grading may be hard and definite, or it may be scarcely perceptible. Promotion may be impossible or unimpeded. The relative dignity of the task may be almost equal throughout a long scale of slow transitions, or different beyond comparison. Footnote. That is, up to the limit of servage and slavery, although very often, as in the present-day East, and as in Rome in the case of Vernae, homegrown slaves, slavery itself may be nothing but a form of compulsory labour contract, and apart from that, hardly sensible. The free employee often lives in far stricter subjection and enjoys far less respect, and his formal right to give notice is in many cases practically valueless to him. End of footnote. Tradition and law, talent and possessions, population numbers, cultural level, and economic situation may effectively override this basic antithesis of subjects and objects. But it exists. It is as much a premise as life itself, and it is unalterable. Nevertheless, economically, there is no worker class. That is an invention of theorists who have fixed their eyes on the position of factory workers in England, an industrial peasantless land in a transitional phase, and then extended the resultant scheme so confidently over all the cultures and all the ages that the politicians have taken it up and used it as a means of building themselves parties. In actuality, there is an almost uncountable number of purely serving activities in workshop and counting houses, office and cargo deck, roads, mine shafts, fields and meadows. This counting up, portering, running of errands, hammering, serving and binding often enough lacks that element which elevates life above mere upkeep and invests work with the dignity and the delight attaching, for example, to the status duties of the officer and the savant, or the personal triumphs of the engineer, the manager and the merchant. But even apart from that, all these things are quite incapable of being compared amongst themselves. The brain or brawn of the work, its situation in village or in megalopolis, the duration and intensity of the doing of it, bring it to pass that farm labourers, bank clerks and tailors' hands live in perfectly different economic worlds. And it is only, I repeat, the party politics of quite late phases that lures them by means of catchwords into a protest combination, with the intention of making use of its aggregate mass. The classical slave, on the contrary, is such chiefly in terms of constitutional law. That is, so far as the body polis was concerned, he simply did not exist. But economically, he might be land worker or craftsman, or even director or wholesale merchant with a huge capital, peculium, with palace and country villas and a host of subordinates, freemen included. And what he could become over and above this, in late Roman times, will appear in the sequel.